So we do have a quiz today. The ones that are here will definitely probably get all 10 points, I hope, with your classmates. And we advertise it on the webpage, too. All right, so we'll get through today's content and then do the quiz. And if you pay attention today, I think you'll get most of the quiz questions also. All right. So we left off talking about muscle, but just before we get going on that, you finished the labs this week with heart, right? Was it going okay? Did your heart beat, right? What did you put on them as a compound? Do you remember? Acetylcholine?
Yeah.
And epinephrine? Did both of them do something? Did one go up, one go down? Did you do both or just one or the other?
One or the other.
And the other. So some of the group did one, some of them did acetylcholine, you mean?
Both groups did both.
Which one did you do first? Did everybody? Acetylcholine and then epinephrine? Why do you think we chose? Why do you think it's that one? Did you get a big change? What happened to heart rate with acetylcholine generally? It went down. All right. What happened with the epinephrine? It went up. Did everybody get that? Your hearts were... Yes, tightness? No, not really. Was it beating a little bit? But sometimes it's a little hard with that string that you've been putting on and that little hook. If it's not just right, pulling on the heart and then the transducer, you don't see it as strong as you might, you know, so everybody's a little bit different sometimes. Sometimes if it beats a little bit to the side, you don't get the signal as well as you might if it's straight on, pulling on that heart. So acetylcholine, what does that do at your neuromuscular junctions, your body, skeletal muscles? Pardon? Somebody said something. Acetylcholine at your skeletal muscles, what does it do? Does it inhibit or excite? Excite. This is what I want to make sure that we, because sometimes in past years people have been confused. They put acetylcholine on the heart of the frog and it decreased heart rate, right? It inhibits in the heart for the beat, and we're going to get to cardiovascular later on. But at your skeletal muscles, the excitatory neurotransmitter, right? So be careful on open response questions, and you get those kind of questions about writing it for when you just say muscle. Yikes. You know, heart is a muscle too, right? So you have to write skeletal muscle, body wall muscles if you want, versus the heart as the heart muscle, okay? So I'm making a point because I don't want you to miss those points, right? And then epinephrine excites the heart, right? Where does epinephrine normally come from to excite the heart in you, for example? Pardon? Adrenal gland in the blood, right? And then also norepinephrine, epinephrine. And this is another point I want to make sure that we get why you just have this lab fresh. You have sympathetic innervation to your heart directly, right? So that can increase not only your heart rate, but also the strength of your heart contraction. So the epinephrine or sympathetic innervation onto your heart can increase the rate. So it's chronotropic, the rate, rate, and it's inotropic, the strength of the heart. So it's both inotropic and chronotropic on the heart. Acetylcholine is basically reduces the heart rate, so it affects chronotropic. Okay? So we're going to come back to that, but while it's fresh in your mind, I just want to make sure that we've hit that. Okay? Is everybody clear with that? Not awake yet. Okay. All right. So that's the part about the labs. So hopefully that was interesting. And some people, you know, I know the hearts are kind of traumatic for some, you know, the frog, and you're seeing the heartbeat right there. But it's a good lab to work with. But when I was a TA for animal physio a long time ago, and we had to use turtle hearts. I think that was really kind of rough because you'd see the turtle, you know, on a board, you know, wired back and stuff. And that, and the turtles are so nice little creatures. So that was really rough. But the turtle heart is a common one that people use. And the reason they would use turtle hearts too is you could actually go to the vagal nerve, the 10th cranial nerve, and you could stimulate it directly, relatively easy. And then it would be like putting acetylcholine on the heart. But you could stimulate it at different rates and you could see the heart slow down. But it doesn't completely stop. So that's kind of interesting too, right? Because it doesn't completely stop. You can't really stop. Did any of your hearts stop with acetylcholine? Yes? No? Maybe? Anybody? Don't remember? Okay. When you have to write it up, you'll remember. Did yours start? Anybody? Okay. But it slowed down? Did it start to slow down and then did it speed back up again? Anybody have that effect? Don't remember? No? Because sometimes, maybe you think about desensitization of the acetylcholine receptors. All right? Like you can get at your skeletal muscles. But we'll talk about more about that when we get to cardiovascular. I'm just kind of setting you up to think about it. All right. Any questions about the lab besides the write-ups? Because that's in the realm of your TAs and Dr. Danley. But on the content of understanding the concepts. If you have any problems with that, you know, email, things like that. But if you have any questions about your write-ups, your grades and that, contact your TAs and then Dr. Danley too. And they will go over how they're grading that, right? So do make appointments with them to make sure you get that down. Because then you have a bigger assignment coming up, right? After the break? Yes? Okay. So that's to build up your stress over the break, just thinking about that? No. This is why we have a break before all that, so you can chill out. Sorry, it's probably not very joking with that. Okay, so let's finish up skeletal muscle, and then we're going to go on behavior, and then we're going to do the quiz and get you out of here. And then Thursday, we'll start some new content, but, you know, in case people are leaving too, there's no quiz. This is why we have the quiz today. Some people I know have, you know, like to vacate a little early. And so if you do, then, you know, everything's on Equine Podcast. No surprises in the class. So hopefully that helps you out if you're planning on splitting early for spring break. You can send postcards if you're out in Florida. Warm us up over here. Okay, so we left off about the shaker muscle and the sonic muscle. Remember the sonic comes from the boatfish that we were talking about and that humming sound that they could make, and people were interested how they could make that sound so fast, and it has to do with this muscle that can beat and relax. And then people found this other muscle that's really quite interesting called the shaker muscle. It's in the rattlesnake tail, and that it can beat. And when you hear that snake rattle, if you hear it rattling really fast, be careful, because that means it can strike really fast too. Because it's kind of slow, you know, early morning like today, you could probably go over there and pick it up with your hand or hit it on its head, and it probably couldn't get you. Because it will be so cold, right? Unless it's warming up. And the rattle will probably be very pathetic rattle. But when you warm them up, that muscle can go even faster. So people have found that if you warm that up to like 35 degrees, look at that. 1.4 milliseconds for the calcium to rise and then go back down so fast. So that's how that muscle can contract. What would happen if it just stayed up? If the calcium just stayed up high? Yes, it would just keep, you know, because now all the active sites are exposed, right? Because calcium binds to troponin C. Troponin C moves. You should go through that in your head. On spring break, just think about that while you're basking in bed until 12 o'clock. And you can think about that while you're waking up for the day. So let's go through that. Action potential down the motor nerve, right? Action potential down the motor nerve. Opens up voltage-gated calcium channels in the presynaptic nerve terminal. Let's think about your skeletal muscle, for example. Calcium comes in. What does it do? It binds to a protein. We named that protein earlier called synaptic tagmin. And then that causes a conformational change. The vesicle then fuses into the membrane, right? And that's a calcium-dependent process. That calcium, as it comes in, it's going to be buffered quickly by calcium-binding proteins, calcium pump, sodium-calcium exchanger, can go into the mitochondria to get that calcium back down after it rises, right? Vesicle fuses to the membrane, though, because of that calcium. That's a quantal response, right? But many vesicles are going to fuse because the calcium's loading up. And then releases neurotransmitter. In your case, it's skeletal neuromuscular junction, acetylcholine, right? Don't write on open response questions that the vesicle goes across the synapse. That's not what happens, right? The vesicle fuses and releases transmitter. And then that transmitter goes across, binds to nicotinic receptors, which are inotropic receptors at your skeletal neuromuscular junction. Those then open up. Those are ion channels, nicotinic, inotropic versus metabotropic. On your heart lab that you did, those are metabotropic receptors. They work through second messenger cascades. We'll talk more about those later on. But inotropic at your neuromuscular junction, that means they open up, they're an ion channel. Sodium goes in, some potassium comes out. What happens to that membrane? It depolarizes, your skeletal muscles, like the frog, you can go to a threshold, have an action potential, right? Action potential travels down the plasma membrane, down the T-tubules. What's the protein that's going to have the conformational change down the T-tubules generally? Dihydropyridine receptors. Remember, you're going to get confused. I mentioned that. The ranitidine and dihydropyridine. So it's dihydropyridine, alphabetic order, dihydropyridine, then ranitidine, okay? That's the way to remember that. So the dihydropyridine receptors, they name that because of the pharmacological identification. But just think of it as a protein that changes its conformational change with that voltage change, right? It changes its conformation, and then it can relate to inside the cell, inside the myoplasm, and it's attached to another protein. That protein is attached to the ER, the sarcoplasmic reticulum inside the cell. What's that protein? The ranitidine receptor. And it's like pulling the bathtub plug out, right? And think of the SR, sarcoplasmic reticulum, that's the bathtub of calcium. Then that calcium dumps out. Calcium's now in the cytoplasm. Binds to troponin C, right? C for calcium. Causes a conformational change. Exposes the active site on actin. Then that active site, the myosin heads are just waiting to attach, so they're looking for that active site all the time. They see the active site, what are they going to do? Contract, right? So the myosin heads move forward, sliding filament, right? Does the A-band shorten? A-band is the myosin, right? So that doesn't really shorten, but the other band can shorten, depends which band we're talking about. But the actin then slides over the myosin, right? Because the heads are pulling the actin together. And then if the calcium's still around, like you mentioned, then that active site's still exposed. The head can come off if it cleaves what? ATP, right? So the ATP hydrolyzed. You don't have to know all the little steps inside exactly where it's happened, but just know that that's an ATP-dependent process, and that's cleaved. So ATP, the heads can cock back, and then if the active site's still exposed, they can bind to that, ratchet forward, and keep contracting. So what stops this contraction? Taking the calcium back up in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, then it comes off the troponin C, so it doesn't have a real strong, binding association, right? I mean, it's not going to stay on there. It's going to disassociate relatively easy when calcium drops back down. But what takes that calcium? Pumps, right? Pumps into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So it's going to be pumped back in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And depending on how many pumps you have in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, you'll see that calcium signal to rise and go down quickly, right? Because it can pump it back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum really quick, cause the muscle to relax so it can contract again. So that pump is really important for the rate of contraction and relaxation, right? Yes. There, you got a quiz question. Okay. So that's really important. Okay? Calcium is really important to pump that back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum and relax that muscle so it can beat again. So relaxation, contraction, right? And that's what's happening in the sonic and in the shaker muscle. If you block those pumps, then it's going to stay in that, it's going to be a hard time. It can come out, but it can't be taken back up. And there are drugs to block these pumps. And sometimes those are used in some aspects for cardiac pathologies in humans too. So that's kind of interesting. But they did a lot of these studies in these particular muscles that helps us to understand how our body works. And so that's neat. So now the calcium's back in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. The troponin C doesn't have the calcium around. Conformational change back. Hide the active sites. The myosin heads might come back with ATP, but there's nothing to bind to. And if you're pulling on the muscle, then you can elongate it, right? And usually an antagonist of the muscle, right? So the opposite muscle could then stretch that one out. You can't have the two really contracting together because that would tear up the muscle, right? But, and sometimes where they worry about it, like with epileptic seizures, is you can have motor neurons to your agonist and antagonist muscles going together, and that can actually cause muscle damage. Okay, so that's interesting. All right, so we got that down generally. So write it down as a path. But also you can think about, why does calcium not keep coming back in? You can think about, well, the nerve stops firing, right? So you stop the depolarization of the plasma membrane, so you don't keep the dihydropyridine in a conformational change, so you don't keep the plug pulled out. So that's part of it too, right? It's not just that the calcium goes back up and there's no calcium. There's no more calcium dumping out because the electrical events aren't coming down the T-tubule anymore, right? You're not depolarizing the membrane, which means that
nerve terminal probably stop firing in normal conditions, right? So you could write out like a schematic for you to make sure you get that down. Okay, are we good with that? All right, good. All right, so we talked about the shaker in sonic muscle, and this is the myoplasm calcium. You can see how fast it goes up and down. People have done this with calcium imaging techniques, and they can see that calcium spike, basically, go up and down really quickly, and temperature dependence. And then that relates to the force of muscle contraction, right? The faster you raise that calcium, the faster the muscle contraction can happen, and again, then higher temperature, all that speeds up. So pretty fast, 8.5 milliseconds. Wow, 8.5 milliseconds. That's like so fast, right? You can't even, like 1/1000, right? Milliseconds, you know, 1/100th of a second, or 1/1000th of a second. So 8.5 milliseconds. I mean, think how fast that is. It's kind of hard to comprehend, right, initially. Right? Millisecond, less than a second. So fast. Okay. All right, so now let's think about, we're getting away from skeletal muscle. There's so much we could talk about skeletal muscle, but we have to move on. So if we think about the heart, and we're going to come back to the heart again when we talk about cardiovascular system. But just to put this in context with the skeletal muscle to compare. You have the banding pattern in heart muscle, right? But what else is different about it in cardiac muscle that somebody might have read about? You get the banding pattern, but is it always lined up as nicely as skeletal muscle? No, it's kind of, we still see the banding, but the way the myofibrils kind of are arranged, they're a little bit chaotic because of the way your heart works, right? It's a circular contraction, basically. But it still has that banding pattern. And not only that, you're going to have these detubules, but they have a lot of sarcoplasmic reticulum also. And then you have gap junctions, right, in heart muscle, right, electrical conduction. The other aspect of the heart muscle is the plasma membrane. Calcium can not just come from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, but it also comes across the plasma membrane. So that's a big difference, is calcium comes across the plasma membrane in addition to the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, and if we look at a table here, this you really want to go through this table. I know it might be hard to see in the back, but you really want to go through there and make sure that you understand the points here, especially the main points. If you had to explain some differences, like four or five different characteristics of skeletal muscle to cardiac muscle in comparison, that you could do that. So really, for studying for some of these contents, a blank piece of paper is really good, right? Because that then you really know it. If you just kind of look at these figures in PowerPoint, you kind of recognize it. So if you had a multiple choice test, you might be able to guess. But this next test doesn't have a lot of multiple choice. This next test is a lot of fill in the blank, all right, open response. You have a lot of time to do that, but you know, you don't want to mess it up and forget and just have a total blank. So the best way to study for this next exam is really to take out a blank piece of paper and write down what you know when you're going through this content. Like the synaptic transmission that we just talked about, muscle contraction and relaxation, the differences of skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle, and then smooth muscle we'll talk about. So you have a visible banding pattern. That means the sarcomere that we've talked about. We've had people mention in past years they didn't know what the banding pattern meant. The banding pattern is the sarcomere arrangement. Okay, and the myosin thick filaments and thin filaments, that contraction process. It's the same aspect with the tropomyosin and troponin. And the T-tubules, you know, to go down the depth of the muscle. Sarcoplasmic reticulum, well developed in both. But here's a big key difference as we start to get down towards innervation, right? Skeletal muscle, these are somatic type of innervated. I mean, things that somite, where they came from. But the heart, the innervation is parasympathetic and sympathetic. So that's where we refer to that as autonomic innervation. But your heart can beat without the nerves, right? It's myogenic. You can cut the sympathetic, you can cut the parasympathetic. And we talked about that, I think, before. What happens if you cut both the sympathetic and parasympathetic innervation to your heart? Let's say your heart's beating at 70 beats a minute, and we cut both the sympathetic and parasympathetic, so it just beats on its own. Would it speed up? Would it slow down, generally, if you're at rest? What do you think? Slow down? it's a good idea. 50-50, right? It's like those multiple choice, true-false questions. You go 50-50. It'll actually speed up. So your heart is generally at rest, suppressed by your parasympathetic innervation. So when you cut both the sympathetic and parasympathetic, it'll usually speed up. So it's kind of interesting to think about. Okay, and then the calcium, that's what we just mentioned, from skeletal muscle, from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. But in the heart, both extracellular and the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And this is important because your heart is around the cardiac sac, and that fluid that's around there, that can really influence how the heart functions and contracts. So that calcium load in there is really important. And then gap junctions for electrical conduction. We just mentioned that. They're in the heart, not in the skeletal muscle. And then, you know, you don't want the heart beating so fast that it can't fill up, right? Well, as we mentioned when we were looking at the outreach center, we talked about that small little chamber that was in that hypertrophic heart that we saw, right? But it could speed up and beating. Okay, and then length and tension, we didn't really get too much into that. Okay, so then what's the other thing about this that's confusing is that in the invertebrates, so here's the key point that we don't want to confuse. So really, you know, that you got this out. In the invertebrates, particularly like insects, crustaceans, arthropods, right? All those fit in arthropods. The skeletal muscle in the arthropods, which is the majority of animals out there in the world, the muscle fibers for body wall contraction, they can take calcium from the extracellular as well as the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So they have calcium channels on their plasma membrane. And so when that depolarizes, that could open up voltage-gated calcium channels, and calcium can come in through the sarcoplasm, through the plasma membrane. But also, if they have a sarcoplasm, they can actually get calcium to come into the myocell from calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So why isn't that? Why don't invertebrates always have a sarcoplasmic reticulum? Well, think of an invertebrate that's very small and has a single muscle fiber. Why do you need a sarcoplasmic reticulum with a very small muscle fiber? Right? Because the sarcoplasmic reticulum, you see it more developed in the animals that have a thicker contractile element of their muscle fiber. So that's to get calcium all over the troponins, right? But if you have a small muscle fiber that's very small, you don't need a lot of calcium. You don't need calcium to go in from all over because it's so small, it can just diffuse across the plasma membrane, and right there is the contractile elements. Okay, so it's a really nice structure function. You can look at invertebrates, for example. You can look at their body wall muscles, and the ones with thicker and thicker body wall muscles in the groups that they have, like the crayfish has a little bit of it, you'll start to see the sarcoplasmic reticulum. The bigger the muscle gets, then you see more invaginations of the plasma membrane, and you see a more developed sarcoplasmic reticulum. It fits really nicely with that calcium diffusion to get to all the troponins to have contraction. So it's really quite neat. So don't get confused. Body wall muscles in mammals, calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. But in invertebrates, the majority of cases, the calcium comes is like the heart muscle, right? It comes from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, if it's there, but also through the plasma membrane. Okay? And one other thing we wanted to make sure that we get down from invertebrates to... Where is this thing? From like mammalian muscle, okay, is that if you had a muscle fiber... Let me see if this is going to be drawing right. Okay. And I think we talked about this a little bit before, maybe. Okay, so let's see. Is this all... Yeah, this thing's kind of crazy. Okay. I will try to draw it over here. All right. We'll, so this should be captured on echo, hopefully. So let's put vertebrate up here. Or let's put mammal. And let's put invert, arthropod, crayfish. So let's think about your skeletal muscles. So you have a muscle fiber. Do your muscle fibers have multiple neurons that go to that same muscle fiber? No. So in the majority of your muscle fibers, you have a motor neuron that will go to the belly of that muscle fiber. It might go to two different muscle fibers, but you don't have a muscle fiber innervated by two types of motor neurons. That seems to be an MCAT type of question too. All right, but there is an exception to this. And I think I mentioned it when we were in the outreach center, but maybe not to all the sections because it's kind of ad hoc when we do that. One thing that's different in these kind of skeletal muscles, but really this muscle is so uniquely different, is your eye muscle. The muscles around your eye, these six different types of muscles around your eye, they actually can have polyneuronal innervation. They can actually have multiple motor neurons to the same muscle fiber. But that's an exception. All right? And part of it is that they come from a different embryological origin than your somatic muscles from your body. All right? If you ever get embryology course, really good. So that's an exception, but most of your body wall muscles innervated by a single motor neuron, and they innervate in the belly of the muscle fiber, right? The belly of the muscle fiber. Why in the belly of the muscle fiber? Well, these muscles make action potentials, right? So you release the acetylcholine, go to a threshold, and boom, an action potential travels the length of the muscle fiber, right? So you get an action potential the length of the muscle fiber. And that's really good because then it goes down the T-tubules all together. You get nice contraction, right? All over. It's not just in the belly, and then you don't get any contraction on the rest of the fibers. Now let's look at the invertebrates. And well, also we should mention in the vertebrates, you always have excitatory. These are always excitatory, right? We did talk about fast and slow muscle, right? Red and white, phasic and tonic, kind of the same, right? That where you use this different terminology, but we don't want to see an open response question. The phasic muscle and a slow motor neuron, you know, don't get it confused. Phasic, white, fast, right? Red, slow, tonic. You know, those two different classifications. The motor neurons generally fit that same type of fiber. And we did mention that you can't completely change over a muscle fiber by exercise, right? But you can slightly put it that direction, but it's not going to completely convert. A lot of experiments done in the 70s was really quite neat to show that activity can make a difference on the muscle fiber types. And what they did is they cross-innervated. They took a slow muscle fiber in the leg of the cat, and a lot of times this was done in cat muscles. They would take a slow motor neuron, like to a slow muscle fiber. They would cut that, and then cut the fast motor neuron to the fast muscle fiber and cross-innervate. And then they would re-innervate the muscle fibers. The muscle fibers would generally show a trend of transition, but they didn't completely switch over. Fast doesn't completely come a slow, and a slow won't completely turn to a fast, okay? So, but there is a somewhat of a change based on activity, but not a complete transition. It's genetically determined in some activity-dependent process. And when you were developing as a fetus, as an infant, thyroid hormone has a major function, when we get to endocrine, on muscle fiber development and muscle fiber phenotypes. Okay, so hopefully that kind of keeps that all straight. If you have any problems with that, make sure you get that down. Now, the invertebrates are really kind of interesting, the majority of animals in the world, because not only can you have a muscle fiber innervated by one motor neuron, but you can have them innervated by multiple motor neurons. Okay? So you get the idea that you could have a muscle fiber, a single muscle fiber, innervated by multiple motor neurons and different types of motor neurons. So you could say, like, this is a tonic. You can have even a phasic. You could put, like, two pluses for a phasic if you want, or a fast. So this is kind of interesting because we have that motor neuron that can kind of change the muscle based on the activity of the motor neuron. But then what about this muscle fiber in an invertebrate that has both a tonic motor neuron and a phasic motor neuron on the same muscle fiber? What's that muscle fiber going to be like? Is it going to be more of a fast? Is it going to be more of a slow? or something in between, what would you say? What do you think? Versus a muscle fiber that might only have, let's do another one, just to keep you going for drawings, that might just have only one motor neuron to it. And you could even have another muscle fiber, if you want to keep going, that would just have this type. Maybe we'll branch it over here. So it only has the phasic, and this one only has the tonic. And these have both the tonic and the phasic. All right. What do you think? Muscle fiber type. If we took those muscle fibers out, ran them on an SDS page gel, we looked at the banding pattern, and we looked at the myosin ATPase activity, or you looked at some other properties of slow and fast muscle that we talked about before. A guess. No guesses. Not enough coffee. Caffeine. They fit very well. The tonic muscle would be more of a tonic type. The phasic muscle would be more of a fast type or a phasic muscle. And the ones with the mix, tonic and phasic, show a in-between type. So it's really quite interesting. So they can have both. And these are excitatory, right, that we've talked about. In the invertebrates, majority of the cases, not always, but in the majority of the cases, it is, what's the neurotransmitter? Glutamate, exactly. Glutamate. Okay, glutamate. And we talked about just excitatory now, but a lot of the invertebrate muscles, it depends what invertebrates, not always the case, many times in the crustaceans, but not always in the insects, is that you have an inhibitory motor neuron. And that inhibitor can go to every muscle fiber, but you can also have inhibitors that go to specific muscle fibers. So you can have what's called a common inhibitor that can go to all the muscle fibers in, like, say, opening the claw, right? There's a common inhibitor to all those muscle fibers, but you can also have a specific inhibitor that can go to some muscle fibers. And that's kind of interesting, too. And what's the neurotransmitter for the inhibitor? GABA, exactly. And why is this so interesting? We went through a little bit of the history before, remember we talked about the guy Ed Kravitz that looked at the enzymes that actually make the transmitters? And there's one enzyme difference from the glutaminergic to the GABAergic neurons, and they actually did this by separating out the motor axons on the opener of crabs and lobsters and crayfish and actually stain for the enzyme, and they could actually show what transmitter is going to be released from that by looking at the enzymes that make those transmitters, and found that there's just one enzyme difference from the glutaminergic to the GABAergic neurons, and they can stain for that, and then realize, oh, that's making GABA, and that was a glutamate decarboxylase. That opened up so much understanding of how your brain works, because when they realized they could stain for the enzymes, they then started slicing up mammalian brains, you know, rodent brains, and then staining, and they could say, oh, that neuron's making glutamate, that neuron's making GABA. And so it really opened up total big change to understand how your nervous system works by staining those, but done in the simple animal like the lobster. Okay, so you can have inhibitors and exciters. So what do we want to write down here is that you have polyneuronal innervation. You can have exciters and inhibitors, and you can have multiple types of exciters. All right, so that will help write that down too. And then you have multiple terminals, multi-terminal. However you want to write that. Okay. And what do we mean by that? And this is why I drew this scattered across the whole muscle fiber versus like the mammalian system, which is just at the bellies, is that many of the cases, not always, but many of the cases in the invertebrates, it's graded response in the muscle fiber. So if it's a graded response where it innervates and it's just graded right there, what's going to happen? Calcium, voltage-gated calcium channels on the plasma membrane, right, we talked about. So calcium come in right there. What would happen? You would only have a local contraction. So how do you get the whole muscle fiber to contract together, not just where it's innervating? Have the nerve branch out all over. So it branches out all over. And about two-thirds of the muscle fibers in these kind of invertebrates have a motor neuron that goes all over the muscle fiber so it can depolarize it all pretty much uniform, right? So it's not just at the belly. Now, some muscle fibers, like a fruit fly that a lot of people use to understand synaptic transmission muscle fibers, in the larval system, it's graded. And you see terminals all over the muscle fiber. In the adult, that muscle fiber can make an action potential. And then you don't see so many branches all over it. So it's interesting. In the same animal, it can have a differences in development, and the muscle fibers change too with metamorphosis, right? Changing. So it's just to kind of remember, when you think about the vertebrate or mammalian systems and then the invertebrates, the uniqueness and the differences, this really opened up and why people study this a lot, because it looks more like the dendrites in your brain, right? You can look at synaptic transmission, graded responses. You can look excitatory and inhibitory right on a muscle fiber that's easy to record from. You can't do that well in a hippocampal slice or other vertebrate neurons because the dendrites are too small, right? You have to record like in the cell body far from where the synapses might be occurring. Okay, so that's kind of interesting. But this really varies depending on the critter that you're talking about. There was something else I wanted to mention here. I'm forgetting it. Oh, yeah, and the calcium, right, from the plasma membrane, sarcoplasmic reticulum. The fiber types pretty much match the fiber types that you might think about in the mammalian systems. Okay, so that's pretty neat, I think. And then you get on over into smooth muscle. We're not going to spend a lot of time with smooth muscle because it's quite complex, but we're going to talk a little bit about smooth muscle. Where's smooth muscle? Blood vessels, GI tract, right? And it is a bit complicated in the contraction process. But in general, and what do we want to know about smooth muscle? There are two types of smooth muscle in general, right? There's smooth muscle that's called multi-unit smooth muscle and single-unit smooth muscle. So when we say single unit, what do we mean by that? It functions as a single unit, okay? So how can it function as a single unit? Well, it can function as a single unit because it has gap junctions, okay? Because it has gap junctions. So that means the electrical signals can travel all over that smooth muscle. So if you get some kind of initiation in one spot, that muscle fibers all around it are going to contract also, right? So it can all contract together. The main part about the difference of multi-unit is that they're functioning independent of each other. So whatever is going to activate the smooth muscle, let's say it's nerves, you're going to have nerve innervation over here, and nerve innervation over here, and nerve innervation over here, and this muscle fiber is not going to talk to the other muscle fibers. So multi-unit, right? So separate function. And then you don't expect gap junctions. So the big difference is no gap junctions in multi-unit. So when you think about this, the other part is the innervation. So neurogenic means nerves, and myogenic, it can do it on its own. So if you, in a lot of cases, if you stretch that smooth muscle in one spot, you can actually stretch it, and it will cause it to contract, and that can activate the next muscle fiber next to it. So that's good for peristalsis, right? And then the other part to remember, two other main points about smooth muscle, is where calcium comes from. Think of the heart. It's like the heart. It's extracellular calcium as well as the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And not only that, is that then it doesn't show a banding pattern. But this gets confusing over the years. It still uses myosin and actin. It's just not in that banding pattern that you see. But there's still myosin and actin in smooth muscle. And the myosin still is responsible for contraction processes. Okay? So don't get confused just because they don't have the banding pattern that there's not actin and myosin in there. They have actin and myosin, and it still is used for contraction, just not in that nice banding pattern. So that's all I really want to go over with the process of a smooth muscle, is that you have these two different types, multi-unit, single unit, kind of know where the calcium comes from, know how it would initiate neurogenic, myogenic, and that you don't have a banding pattern, okay? And gap junctions is the key. Okay, so one other part just to remember is that the sarcolemma, people sometimes get confused with this. The sarcolemma is that membrane that's around the muscle fiber, right? So the sarcolemma is like plasma membrane that's around this muscle. And then you can kind of see the SR that's inside and a lot of mitochondria because of all the processes that we talked about. Okay. So I know that was fast and furious with skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle and smooth muscle, but it's, you know, every one of these topics, the whole course, right? Just skeletal muscle. We do have a muscle biology course if you're really interested. It's next fall. It's just on skeletal muscle pretty much, a little bit on cardiac. Whole semester just on skeletal muscle. Can you imagine? And guess what? We don't even talk about comparative that much. It's only mammalian skeletal muscle and skeletal muscle diseases. It's taught by HHS, Human Health Sciences Center. So we have a team of different instructors in that course. Okay, are we all good with muscle? Yes? Important? Muscle is really important in the sense of glucose regulation too. It takes up most of the glucose in your blood. If you have orange juice or something like that, and you get glucose raising in your blood, majority of that glucose can be stored quite quickly in skeletal muscle. That's a major sink for glucose. Okay, and then we're into the really fun part of behavior, which kind of pulls together different content. And it's not too heavy to remember things, but we talked about some aspects of behavior already, so we can kind of go through that, speed it up. In ecology class, you've talked about Nikki Tinbergen? Have you talked about Nikki Tinbergen in ecology? Has anybody had ecology? You're in ecology. They talked about Nikki Tinbergen, Conrad Lorenz, Carl Van Frisch.
Semester, but not yet.
Not yet. So these guys won the Nobel Prize in animal behavior ethology, the study of animal behavior in the natural environment. That's ethology. So it's really interesting because now there's terms called neuroethology. So breaking it down. I'm wondering if you ever get cardiac ethology, but you know, the nervous system for behavior, right? So there is a group called neuroethology, but ethology, study of the animals and the natural behavior. So the people that won the Nobel Prize for this, really quite neat. Nikki Tinbergen won it for the digger wasp. I think we talked about that, right? The digger wasp can fly around. And I mentioned that he was a student, and people kind of boohooed him for this, for his graduate project. And later, they said, oh, he's really good. Let's come back, study, you know, finish your dissertation work. Because Conrad Lorenz recognized this guy's work was really good. And then he got a Nobel Prize with Conrad Lorenz. But he was a student in the Netherlands, and he noticed that these digger wasps dig a hole in the sand. They can come out of the sand, they fly all the way away, and come back on a beach and can find that hole again, right? That's pretty hard to find. It's a little wasp, right? Find that little hole. And the way they did this is they came up and hovered around. They learned the spatial orientation, flew off. They could learn that and then go back in that hole. And they would follow back their spatial learning to find out where their hole was back in that sand on the big beach, right? So that's pretty neat. So he studied that work and wrote some really neat general fun reading books if you're interested in animal behavior or understanding kind of looking at a scientific approach. He's written a number of really neat books. Nikki Tinbergen. Conrad Lorenz, you might have heard stories about him. He's really quite a character, an Austrian guy. He studied gray lag geese, the imprinting behavior, right? Like the little ducks that follow the mama duck you've seen on TVs, right? But if you take away mama duck and you pretend you're mama duck like he did, the little ducks would follow him, right? And so imprinting on the parent, for example, and that duck would follow the parent. Important for human behavior as well, right? So he really, bridged a lot of gaps with that. He also studied sickleback fish and their behavior and how they give different signals to other fish, for example. He's done lots of different things about looking at animal behavior. He really changed the way people were looking at behavior of animals, like in an isolated lab environment, and they would behave totally different than they would out in the natural environment, for example. So really quite interesting. If you're ever interested in, you know, if you were in a rodent lab and you're working with rodents and you look at animal behavior on the little wheels that they crawl on, right? You put a wheel in there. If you have a hamster, for example, you hear it all night long, so you put them in your closet so it doesn't keep you awake, right? Because they run that little wheel all night. But that wheel's kind of artificial, right? They don't have wheels out in the natural environment. Well, some researchers actually put wheels out in the environment and kind of got mice to, field mice to run on those, and they found out they liked that little wheel and they would just keep running on it. Some kind of addictive behavior that goes on. But normally they don't, they're not going to exercise that much. They actually showed they probably exercise more when they have the wheel than they would in a natural environment just running around. So some kind of like that runner's high maybe, right? Or exercise high that they have to keep doing it. So really interesting. But also Conrad Lorenz, Nobel Prize for sickleback fish and Greylag geese imprinting. There's a story of Conrad Lorenz. If you ever pick up some of the reading books of Conrad Lorenz, really fun reading. Supposedly he was in his office in Austria and people were going to come in and interview him and stuff. They walked in his office and they found his clothes on the floor. They didn't know what happened to him. And then somebody screamed, some reporter, because he was actually swimming in his big tank naked, looking at a sickleback fish, and he wanted to see what they were doing in the little cove, and so he just took off his clothes and went swimming. So that's Conrad Lorenz. Supposedly he went swimming naked quite a bit in his place in Grunau, Austria, with his other animals that he had. So a real kind of naturalist, I guess. But he also studied wild boar and how boar behavior was interesting, and so he studied lots of different animals. Anyways, then there's Carl van Frisch. Carl van Frisch, he got the Nobel Prize for the bee behavior, bee dance behavior. All right, so how the bees would dance, and then know to signal that, and it's a sensory perception, right, that we were talking about, maybe the vibration, lots of different things about this. It's still being investigated even today about bee behavior and why some bees do this and other bees don't, for example. And then they know where to go and how do they signal. So lots of interesting aspects out there in looking at animal behavior and understanding that. Vincent Dettier, just to mention him, there's a really nice little fun reading book, and there's a number of copies over in your library over here. We got it when we had a seminar course, To Know a Fly. To Know a Fly. And he just studied houseflies. But he wanted to understand how that housefly could fly and then land on the ceiling. Went, how did it do that? Did it do a sideways flip, or did it flip upside down? How did it land on the ceiling? How does it take off? How sensitive is a fly for understanding, what food to eat? And they found out that you could put a little electrode, like you did for stabbing muscle fibers, remember those intracellular electrodes? But break it off and have a very small opening, and you could put it over a single hair on the leg of the fly and put different levels of glucose on it, for example. Or how they respond. So you can actually starve the fly and put this little glucose solution over one hair on the leg, and it would cause a reflex of the proboscis to come down and try to find out where that glucose is, where that sugar is. So he found out that they could detect that glucose at like 1 × 10⁻⁶ concentration. So a micromolar level, much more sensitive than we have in our tongue, for example. And then what kind of sensitivities could they actually respond to? And they have hydroreceptors, all these kind of things. So anyways, really fun things to just think about that we don't normally put it in a whole perspective. So this chapter is on the sensory system, relatively quick that we can go through because some of it's gee-whizzy, but I just want you to think about pulling it all together. That the sensory is important, the integration in the nervous system, and then the output, motor neurons, to the behavior, right? Because if you don't have the output, you don't see the behavior. But you might have a whole different process going on that you can't understand that behavior because they don't elicit that behavior, but the nervous system is very functional, right? And their sensory perception is there, but they might not elicit the behavior that you might miss, that they're not responding to that sensory cue, right? But because they don't elicit the behavior. And so idea two is like chickens pecking, right? They keep pecking, and you put something around them, like a cat. They might see the cat from the distance, but they still keep pecking. But if you monitor their heart rate or some kind of other response, it's going way up. But you look at them, and they don't really seem to be any different because they just keep pecking. They don't want to give the cue out to the predator that they actually respond, and then they might move away, right? Okay? And so that's kind of interesting. So the behavior doesn't tell you everything about the animal. Just like us, you might be thinking something different. You're probably off thinking about spring break already, and what on earth is he talking about? Okay, so that could be too. Just think of that. And then think about simple reflexes versus ones that have integration going on in the brain. And then you think about that behavior or that response to sensory stimuli. The take home here is that it could be affected by the state of the animal. If the state of the animal is really excited, it might respond differently to that sensory stimuli than if it was relaxed, right? Just like you got a paper cut right now in your hand, you probably sense that and you're really responsive to it. But if you're out running or you're doing something and then you have that same kind of cut, you might not even respond to it at all. But your sensory nerves are firing the same way, It's just not being processed the same. So modulator, state of the animal, can really influence that input. We've talked about cells in the brain, for example, stretch-activated channels, right, that can detect your osmolarity in your body. So people study these to look at other aspects in other animals, like if they're hydrated or not. So you think about how do we detect that osmolarity or pH, right, in your body. Think about those receptors. And the same with other animals. They have to maintain their osmolarity, right, because they don't want their cells exploding or shrinking. So when you think about these common principles throughout the animal kingdom, quite interesting. So if you had a cell in distilled water, right, it's going to swell up. It's going to activate the stretch-activated channels. But if they're functioning and you get a little bit of basal activity all the time, you know, if it was in a hyperosmotic environment around it, water will come out and the cell will shrink. But that could change how the firing frequency of that neuron, right? So the same idea to think about. And this is what regulates your osmolarity or your thirst, for example, that behavior of thirst. It's amazing, right? Just stretch-activated ion channels, some spot in your brain, firing that, and then you become thirsty. Right? So it's really quite interesting. Okay, so these are the main things that we've talked about. And we've talked about general photoreceptors before, right? Main things to remember, omatidia, do they depolarize or hyperpolarize with light activity? Omatidia. What's an omatidium, you're thinking? Insect eye, compound eye. Hyperpolarize, depolarize? Insect eye. Chop, chop. Come on. Coffee. We all need coffee. Infusions. They depolarize, right? Insect eyes, light activation, depolarize. Rods and cones and us, mammalian eye, vertebrate eye, hyperpolarize with light activity. Okay. Some other cells in the body, like your crayfish, your wonderful animal, the crayfish, the six abdominal ganglion in the abdomen of the crayfish. What's the abdomen? Oh, our little picture. Here we go. Well, I can't put it on. You know the abdomen over here, right? It's got the segments. The abdomen, the six abdominal ganglion at the very bottom, that sends out nerves to the telson and all that. Inside of there, there are actually photoreceptors. It's not to detect, to see, right? But just to tell if there's light there. And they can respond to that. A really fun lab that could do is to record from the connectives between the sixth abdominal ganglion and the fifth abdominal ganglion, put a suction electrode there, and you can pass light over it, and you can see the firing frequency. What's really fun is you can put different filters across it, red, blue, green, you know, and you can find out what kind of light they respond to. So they respond to the light that from the sun spectrum, and as you might imagine, why would they need a photoreceptor in their sixth abdominal ganglion? Any idea? Their eyes are up here, right? And they can see. They have omatidia, compound eyes. Why would they want photoreceptors in their sixth abdominal ganglion? It's not to see the animal in front of them or the predator. Any ideas?
Make sure they're all the way under the rock.
Exactly. Make sure they're under the rock, like hiding from a predator, right? It's like a little kid hiding, you know, puts his hands in front of their eyes and they're hiding. You can't see me, right? Because they got the hands over their eyes, right? So this is a way to actually show that if light's not shining there, then the predator can't see my tail, right? So they can hide there. But some really fun labs to do that. Even cave crayfish. Kentucky's full of caves, right? We worked with cave crayfish in the past. They don't have any omatidia. It depends on the species of the cave crayfish. No sensitivity to light on their eyes. But you shine a light towards their abdomen, and they can respond to it. Kind of interesting. Completely evolved out the eye structures in some of these species, but they didn't evolve out the light sensitivity in the six abdominal ganglion. Pretty neat. Okay, so also here's a good example of another light sensitivity, the pineal site. So the pineal gland is, if you took your brain and you kind of pulled back your cerebellum, the pineal gland would be there. So the hypothalamus, straight up from the hypothalamus, the base of your brain, straight on up, is the pineal body. It's really quite interesting because people have noted that if you had a tumor there, you really got some really weird issues. And at one time they thought it was the seat of the soul or something like that. And that pineal gland is really important for your circadian pattern, your sleep pattern in you. But it doesn't respond to light anymore. But it has a part of setting your circadian pattern. If you take the sleep course, you'll hear more about your sleep cycle. pineal gland is really important. Melatonin, all that kind of stuff, right? Dopamine. But in fish, they don't have that big cerebellum, and it's called the third eye, and also in birds. Why is it called the third eye? And you can actually shine light on the skull and activate the pineal body. That's pretty cool, because it's a third eye, like a third eye, right? And you can actually set a pattern by just shining light on the pineal body. You can actually change the pattern in that animal. So fish and birds, the pineal gland, or pineal site, can actually respond to light, and the animal then can set this kind of photo period. So pretty interesting. Lots of fun things. So if you looked at here, like, here's your hypothalamus, your pineal gland would be up here, or pineal body, but the cerebellum in us has covered it, but it still functions for our circadian patterns and aspects of sleep cycles. So it's pretty neat, but it's lost that light sensing ability from all these structures that built around it. Nerve networks, if you think of a jellyfish, are a little something like a jellyfish, moonfish they call them. They have these nerve networks, and people still don't understand completely how they work. If you think of that jellyfish, it's rhythm, right? And it can beat and swim through the water, but it's got a nerve net to it. And if you touch it on one side, it can change its pattern, right? But how they all communicate is still kind of a mystery. Some people study them, but it looks like this, kind of chaotic, right? And it's just a nerve net, but it can keep that in a synchronized fashion. So people look at these as the simple nervous system to try to understand communication and how they can communicate. And looking at some of the neurotransmitters, in some cases I think serotonin might be the earliest neurotransmitter around, because they find these in the very simple nervous systems. But also ATP is thought to maybe be the first neurotransmitter, because all neurons package ATP and the synaptic vesicles also. So that's pretty cool, right? So very cool things about looking at it on the comparative aspect. Okay, so two other systems. We won't talk too much about them. They're really cool. The top one is the leech. I should have brought in a leech. I had some leeches. And the bottom one is this aplysia. And these animals, the aplysia and the leech, were some of the first animals to really try to investigate quite a bit to understand their nervous system. So the leech is a segmental animal, right? It has segments. And each segment has a ganglion associated with it. And so that ganglion is repeated over and over and over again. Kind of like your spinal cord, right? Segment, 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 segment. And these segments communicate. You're very segmental also. But this is even more so, because a segment, a ganglion, and then connect was going to the next ganglion. And then connect was going to the next ganglion. And each ganglion in the leech system has 400 neurons. Every neuron in the leech ganglion has a name or a number. Isn't that amazing? They know every neuron in that ganglion. And you think, well, why would anybody waste their time doing that kind of stuff, right? But why do they waste their time doing that stuff? The cell bodies are very big. So if you look at that scale of micron over there, it's 200 microns right there. And you see those two big cells that are up there at the top? These actually have names. They're called Ritzia cells. So people would study these, and they're so big that you can put an intracellular electrode in them, right? And you can study that. And you can study the shape of the action potential. You can do different things to it. It's kind of like the squid system, right? But not only that, if you know the names of these cells, then you can put multiple electrodes in them. And there's a guy down at Emory, Ron Calabrese. Emory has a very good neurobiology program, and computational neurobiology too, if you're interested in grad programs. So Ron Calabrese, he's been studying the leech system for over 20 years. What he does with his students, and there's undergraduates work in his lab, I think they even have a summer program if you're interested. They would take a leech, cut out the skin on a segment, put it on a pedestal, right? Put saline around it. And the leech, the head and the tail is free in the water around it in the saline. And he would put electrodes in the known neurons, right? And so he knew which neurons he's in, because the shape of the action potential gives you a characteristic, you know, identity of that neuron. But he could touch the tail and start the undulation starting, right? And then all of a sudden, there's no more body. There's just a connective and a ganglion and a connective, and then the head part of the animal. Well, he would have up to 20 electrodes inside of different neurons. You thought it was bad stabbing one muscle fiber that's really big in a crayfish? try out 20 intracellular electrodes, right, in all the different neurons. So you have tiny manipulators, electrode in, another one, electrode in. What happens if your hand hit it? Or you broke one electrode and mess up the whole experiment, right? So he would go around and stab all these different cells, know which ones are there, have all the traces going at one time, and then he could have that undulation. So he would know the firing pattern of which neuron's firing first and which one would communicate the next one, next one, next one, and understand the swimming behavior. So he actually built computational programs to mimic that behavior. And now people can go in and actually use the computer program and alter, say, what if we take out that neuron, what's going to happen to the neural circuit? Well, they could do that experiment. They could actually have that intracellular electrode and inject a compound like a pronase that would actually eat up that cell and kill that one cell out. So you could kill that one cell and see if it changed the pattern. The Navy was very interested in this, and the Army was very interested in this, because these were some of the first studies to build robotics. They used the systems that people came up with, computational analysis like this, to build robotics. Not only that, the medical community got very interested in this for prosthetics, prosthetic limbs, for example, right? It all goes together. So some of this early work in understanding pattern behavior in neural circuits, they could then mimic with computational programs to build prosthetics or robotics. And so it's really quite neat. And a lot of that work started early on the leech. Not only that, a real quick point about the leech. What does your glia cells do in your brain? Anybody? Glial? We talked about glia, right? It's like the glue of your brain. You have more glial cells in your nervous system than you do neurons. They hold all your neurons together, right? What else might be a function of a glial cell, do you think? Any ideas? Really important. Maybe maintenance of the myelin surrounding, you know, activity, oligodendrocytes, Schwann cells. That's important too. And not only that, depends on when we talk about neurotransmission later. We'll come up back to it a little bit. But people didn't really know what the glial cells did. What's interesting about this leech system, just real fast, is you see these little packets? There's like a little outline here, another little outline here, another little outline here, another little outline there. That's a glial cell that has wrapped around, like for the myelination in a sense, but these are not myelinated. They wrapped around a group of neurons. So this cell has kind of taken on these groups of cells. What they found out is that you could stimulate that Ritzia cell with an intracellular electrode, repetitively stimulate it, and you could have another electrode in the glial cell, not in the neuron, but in the glial cell. And you saw the glial cell depolarize. Wow. The glial cell depolarizes when you stimulate the neuron, and it would relate to the frequency of stimulation that you give to that neuron. Well, they found out that if you give it the neuron activity, what comes out of the cell with an action potential? Sodium goes in. What goes out? Potassium. So that potassium, where does it go? If it hits neighboring neurons, what's it going to do to neighboring neurons? What happens when you raise potassium outside those muscle fibers that you did in the lab? What happened to the muscle fiber? It depolarized, right? Well, you don't want your neighboring neuron to depolarize, do you, if this one's active? So this was some of the first studies to understand what glial cells do. And glial cells can take up that potassium from the activity of a neighboring neuron. So if one neuron's active in your nerve, you know, the nerve in your arm, for example, you don't want the neighboring neuron to depolarize just because of the activity of this neuron. So it keeps that potassium in check. So some of the first studies in understanding what glial cells might do came from the nervous system of the leech, because they could do the recordings directly. So that's pretty neat. Not only that, just a real quick one, regeneration and repair of the nervous system, understanding your spinal cord repair, right? Some of the first work was done actually in the leech system. And neural regeneration and repair, some of the first studies in the leech, and they still use it as a model, because you can take those connectors between the two ganglia, you can pinch them, break the neurons, break them, not, you know, totally cut it out, but just break them apart, and you can see they lost their connections, and they kind of regress inside of this sheath that's around them. But then you wait a couple days, and the neurons grow through that injury site, and then connect up to the right target again. Wow, they go to the right target. They bypass the other end, and they go and they keep following, and they go to the right target and innervate that so they can get the swimming back. They can actually crush, look at that swimming's defective, for example, in that segment, and then wait a couple months, and then it can swim just fine. So they began to look at the aspects of how those neurons contract, get to the right location, make the right connections. So some of the earliest work in regeneration repair, we can thank the researchers in the leech system. Now, what's different about the aplasia? The aplasia is not such a nice system as the leech and segmental. They just have these ganglion kind of all over in their body. But a lot of work was done in the aplasia system, and we talked about it with Eric Kandel. Remember, he got the Nobel Prize. Worked on the hippocampus, looking at learning and behavior, because in the aplasia, that's that sea slug where you touch the siphon, and they could withdraw the siphon, could electrically shock it, and it would stay, you know, pulled in the siphon. And you study habituation, the neural control of habituation, for example. And associative learning with the electrical shock. So he actually would study that in the intact animal and then take out the nervous system and recreate that same neural circuit to relate to that behavior. Pretty cool. But these cells are so big. Look at that. 500 microns. That's a half a millimeter. Wow. That's gigantic, right? I mean, that's really big. So they could take out a single cell and run it on an SDS page gel. You could actually look at the banding pattern of the proteins in that single neuron. You can't do that with mammalian neurons, right? So it was really early on before they had PCR where you could amplify the messenger RNA in small cells. You could actually look at the proteins in a single neuron and map it out and see if activity caused different expression in these neurons based on activity, for example. So a lot of the early work pioneered in these systems. There's the beautiful leech system, aplasia system, and again, you could isolate the neurons. Now, we could spend the rest of the semester just talking about this critter, but we have a quiz to give. So let's kind of organize ourselves where we're not next to each other, like a row apiece, a row apart, or something, slide on over. The quiz is easy. Put your name on it. Circle the right answer, and you will be good. So kind of separate out rows, separate. Try to cover up the seats too, don't expose your answers to neighbors. Started over there with last year.
Thank you.
name on there. And circle. Should be quick. Should be easy. Oh my God.
Don't think too hard. I will be towards the back. You can hand in your quiz on the way out.